Please join me in welcoming our main speaker from Fresno, bank robber Mike L.
Thank you, brother. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
All right, so the bank robber thing. We'll get to that in the story. Usually I'm not nervous when I speak, and guess what? I'm not nervous. So we're, you know, something's working right today. My name is Michael L., and I'm an alcoholic. I've been sober since August 27th, 2001. I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous to stop drinking. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous to stay out of prison. Okay, so I'm going to be openly and honest as I could possibly be right now. I'm still selfish, I'm still dishonest, I'm still resentful, and I'm still fearful. Okay, those are the four things the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous tells us that we have to consistently look out for in our recovery from alcoholism. So I would just like to thank everybody for being here tonight. I saw the rain and you guys coming out for this. I wouldn't have came. I would have stayed home. I'm like a homebody now. I have a dog in sobriety. And we sit on the couch, and he looks at me, I look at him, and I tell him it's raining outside, we better stay home, and we stay home. So that's how my life has changed today. That's one example of that. So, okay, I'm much like everybody else, you know what I mean? I enjoyed drinking, okay? I enjoyed it until it didn't bring me joy anymore, okay? So the choice to drink was removed, and I had to drink, okay? So my story also, and I don't apologize for it, my drug of choice is cocaine, okay? But I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've remained sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I found out that if I don't drink, I usually don't go buy an ounce of cocaine. So I kind of killed two birds with one stone by joining Alcoholics Anonymous. But for those of you who do suffer from the other addictions of outside issues, God bless you, keep coming back, and Alcoholics Anonymous works, okay? The 12 steps works, you know what I mean? Today, my life is a lot different. Like I said, much like everybody else, I drank at an early age. 13 years old, I can remember drinking 3 Heinekens, and I had a killer buzz. I was like, this is great, and I was funnier, I was everything more. You know what I mean? It was just better, you know? And I don't think I ever drink a Heineken again after that, but those 3 Heinekens really set me on my way. And throughout high school, my, you know, adolescent years, I would drink. I would leave after fourth period of lunch and go drink. I was up to 240s at lunchtime, and I would go back to Old English 800. I would drink 2 of those at lunchtime and go back to fifth period. And walk in and hit the stairs, you know what I mean? You're walking in and you're and just reeking like malt liquor, thinking that nobody knows, you know? And that's one of the illusions of the alcoholic, is thinking that nobody else knows. You know what I mean? And I was, my sponsor says he was the last one to find out he was an alcoholic. So I can relate to that, you know what I mean? And I can remember friends in junior high school, high school, they would say things like, what are you going to do about your drug problem? And I would look at him like, what are you talking about? You're the one with the problem. I don't have a problem. So, you know, it progressively got worse. My disease of alcoholism and drug addiction and isms, the I and the self and the me, it becomes more and more and more. You know what I mean? And once I start, I can't stop. Okay? So throughout high school, I would do like really well. I was always an above average student. I was involved in student government, athletics, but I would do really well, then I would party too much. And I'd do really well, then I'd party too much. So my senior year, I said, you know what, I really need to settle down. You know, one of those self-talks, like, you need to settle down. You know, one of those serious self-talks, you really need to settle down. I know, I need to settle down. No, you really need to settle down. And I did that, and you know, I ran for senior class president, and I won. And I spent all our money on beer. I bought kegs of beer for, like, we would have keggers on Friday night and Saturday, and yeah, so I was already, you know, stealing money from the student class account, and it progressively got worse. And like I said, you know, my drug of choice is cocaine, but it always starts with Budweiser, okay? So it got really bad. My senior year, it got really bad in high school, and I knew that I couldn't make it to first period. Okay, even though I had like A's and B's in all my classes, I had too many absences in first because I was just barely getting home or coming to. So I had too many absences, and the vice principal said, "You know, Michael, you're not gonna get your diploma. We'll allow you to walk with the class and represent as senior class president, but you'll have to come back to summer school to get your actual diploma." And I was like, "Nah, I'm just gonna drop out." So I dropped out the week before graduation, despite Mr. Nation, that was his name, Mr. Nation. And I can remember being in the bleachers of the high school that I was supposed to graduate from, drinking Budweiser, high on cocaine, yelling for all the kids that I'd went to school with since grammar school, and yelling and shouting for them. And it was weird, it's like all the parents were in the stands with me, and I'm drinking Budweisers, you know, and nobody said anything. Nobody pulled me and said, "Michael, what are you doing?" You know, and I don't know why, but that's my story, you know. And so at 18 years old, I said, "You know what? I have a cocaine problem, and I know that it's linked to my drinking. I need to do something." But instead of like going to rehab or something like that, or going to meetings, I said, "You know what? I'll move to LA. That will help me with my problems." So I literally hitchhiked from Fresno, California to Los Angeles on a promise that I might be able to rent a room. I had $20, 3 cans of tuna, I'm a diabetic, couple bottles of insulin, and I go to LA. I get a job like the second day I'm there putting together custom brass lamps in this sweatshop, and I do that for like 3 days, and I'm thinking, I can't do this. And a friend of a friend told me that I could get hired on at Universal Studios, because if you don't have a record, you can get a job there. And I got hired at Universal Studios. And I'm at Universal Studios. This is like 5 days after I get to LA, homeless pretty much. And I get a job at Universal Studios. And I fall into this great job. You know, alcoholics fall into like the best opportunities, but they can't fulfill them. You know what I mean? But the door is open and you're able to do these things. And I went to work for Angela Lansbury on Murder, She Wrote. And I was in charge of the food. I was the production assistant in charge of the food. And I'm thinking, man, this is great. You know what I mean? Then I see Gerald McCraney from Major Dad. And I'm like, oh my God, is that Andy Griffith over there? Oh my God, how did I get here? And I'm not drinking and I'm not using cocaine. Okay, I'm smoking marijuana, all right? That's a thing nowadays, by the way, if you didn't know. But I was just smoking marijuana, and I knew that if I drank, I would, you know, get that itch that had to be scratched, so I stayed away from alcohol, and, you know, I'm working there, and everything's going really well. You know, I'm 19, almost 20 years old, and everything's going really well. And I got a motorcycle now, I got a job, and, you know, when you or an alcoholic and you're not drinking. By the way, alcohol is the perfect cure for alcoholism. Until it's not, okay? So without the alcohol, my alcoholism is just manifesting into everything, you know, everything. And, you know, it was a short period of time, maybe a year and a half down there. And we had come across a drunk store clerk at a Circle K that was passed out on the counter. And we're like, we go in to wake him up, and I'm thinking, man, so we're looking around, well, what about all this beer? What about all these cigarettes? So we took all these cases of beer and all these cigarettes, and I had like 20 cases of beer, you know? So a couple beers. I'm still working for Angela Lansbury, still going to work. You know, but I got all this beer. Now I'm drinking more beer. And then I meet Little Jimmy. Little Jimmy knew the neighbor, and Little Jimmy had a 5.0 Mustang, and he'd come rolling down the street. And he was buying cocaine, crack cocaine, for a priest in Burbank that was giving him $500 a day to go to MacArthur Park and buy crack cocaine. And that sounded like a great idea. So I went with Little Jimmy to MacArthur Park to get some crack cocaine for the priest in Burbank. Okay? So I did that for like a week. I don't like crack cocaine. I'm not a crackhead, but when you're drinking Budweiser, crack is great. You know what I mean? Crack is great. One thing leads to another. Eventually, I find some bikers up in a place called Tahunga. And I found a bathtub full of biker dope. For those familiar back in the 80s, and yeah, so, wow. So, you know, I lose 50 pounds really fast. Really fast. I decided to quit Universal Studios. I quit my job. And I remember the excuse that I used was that they would send us our paychecks every 2 weeks. And we'd get them. They were always wrong. But, you know, obviously, if they overpaid me, I wouldn't say anything. But if they didn't pay me for a shift, how dare they not pay me for my time? You know? So I use that as an excuse. So 2 weeks goes by, and another check came. And I was like, oh, well, you know, when you get hired, sometimes they pay you for the 2 weeks, they hold back, I thought. Didn't have a lot of job experience. And two more weeks goes by, and another check comes. Yeah, I like this. I'm smoking weed. I'm not drinking. All that Budweiser's been drank, you know what I mean? And that's what sets me off. So, but now I'm thinking, man, I wonder if I'm going to get a check next Wednesday. You know, and they kept coming. And a month went by, and 2 months went by. And I told them they had an accounting problem. I had told them, you know, they had an accounting problem. And then 4 months went by, and 5 months went by, and I go out there to get my check on a Wednesday, and there was no check. Those dirty bastards stopped paying me after 5 months. How dare they? I needed that money. I was counting on that money. So I go back to Fresno. You know, I go back to Fresno, and I go back. I'm homesick. I'm, you know, I'm 20 years old now at the time. And I go back, get a job at Domino's Pizza. And, you know, I'd worked at a pizza place in high school, and I knew how to make pizzas. And now I'm the manager, and I buy a new car. And I'm just smoking weed. I'm not drinking, you know that. And I go to a party in my hometown of Fowler, California. And they had what was called Butterfield's beer. I'd never heard of Butterfield's beer, but it sounded delicious. Because I like butter. I love butter. That's one of my things, is I love butter. Okay? Butterfield's beer. And I was going to go. You know, it was a birthday party. Hadn't seen anybody in a couple years. And, you know, I'm doing well. I got a brand new Nissan Sentra. Yeah, I'm doing well. You know, so I go to this party. I got to unlock, you know, I got to open up the Domino's pizza the next day. And I'll just go and go home early. Go home at 10 o'clock. I get there. And I'm not going to drink. And, I'm thinking, man, Butterfield's beer. I guess I could just have one. I'm going to go home at 10 o'clock. You know? We had the red Solo cups. And I think, nah, I better not. And that voice inside, it's Butterfield's beer. And I succumbed to the Butterfield's beer. And I drank 2 tumblers, had a little buzz, not drunk. And at 10 o'clock, I was like, hey, I gotta go. My buddy needed a ride home. I told him I'd drop him off, and I had to do the responsible thing. I tried to be responsible. Shouldn't have drank the 2 beers, but not my, you know. So I take him back to Fowler, drop him off so I can go home, and I roll the stop sign. And I get my first DUI, December 2nd, 1990. You know, I think it was a week before my 20th birthday. And Domino's, they frown on their managers or their drivers having a DUI. So I lost my job. Now I can't pay for the new Sentra. And, you know, I have a long, sordid story. I'm just going to kind of run through it. But so I'm kind of depressed. You know, I probably need medication too, but, you know, the symptom that I have with depression is that if I'm not drinking or not using without a sufficient substitute, I will become depressed, I will become isolated, and I will become lonely, okay? So what happens was I'm depressed. I'm like, oh man, I lost my job. I'm going to lose my Sentra. Oh no, what am I going to do? You know, so I'm watching 2020. And they have a bank robbery special on. I'm watching this special and they're showing how to go rob a bank and everybody's doing it. Thinking, well, damn, what do you mean they have to give you the money? They can't stop you. Wow, really? You should rob a bank. And it was the same voice that said I should drink a Butterfield's beer too. The same freaking voice. So the next morning I went to my local branch in Bank of America, and I had a note. That's the first one I ever robbed with a note. I never used a note again. It was a polite note. Please give me 10s, 20s, and 50s. Please, no marked bills. That's what I did. I robbed a bank. And then that next day, I was like, I'd been partying all night, drinking, doing cocaine. And come down a couple of days later, but you only get a couple grand, by the way. One teller, you're going to get a couple grand. So that's gone in like 3 days, 4 days. Then the come down, and then that same voice said, you freaking robbed a bank. Same voice that told me to drink the beer. The same voice that told me, says, yeah, you robbed a bank. Now what are you going to do? And the other voice says, you better go rob another one. You know what I mean? Just like when you drink that one beer, when you're not supposed to be drinking, you drink the one, you might as well just drink another one. You know what I mean? So that's my stories. You know, I ended up doing that same thing for 2 years, and I robbed 9 banks, you know, and I ended up not too far from here at 3600 Guard Road in Lompoc, and I spent a nice vacation there for about 4 years. I didn't have any, like I said, when I got hired at Universal, I didn't, you know, have any criminal charges growing up, and I never brandished a firearm, so I was, you know, 4 year term, and 3 years of federal release, supervised release, and I did that. I stayed sober the time I was inside. When I got out, I went right to work. I've always worked. And, you know, when I got out, I didn't address my issues of alcoholism. You know, I would go to a meeting every once in a while. I knew on the educational variety, I knew I shouldn't be drinking at all. You know, it was always bad for me. So I get out of that, and, you know, my sister was an alcoholic too. She never found the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was close to her. She used to save me from my alcoholic mother, and she was like my guardian angel all my life. And then I neglected her when she needed someone, and she shot herself in the head from alcoholism and drug addiction. And you know, after that, I fell apart. I can remember going to the ODAC club, sitting outside talking to Larry, and sitting there crying in the car because I couldn't go inside. You know, I couldn't ask for help, you know, and the pain was too bad. And I had a real, real bad relationship with God at that time. You know what I mean? I had a really bad relationship with God. I continued to do the things I always done. You know what I mean? I drink, I do drugs, I buy drugs, I sell drugs, I cheat, I lie, I steal. I didn't rob banks anymore. I was over that. I had gotten over that, and that was enough for me with that. And so I would drink every day, all day. And then I would do methamphetamine. Cocaine was my drug of choice, but it was always ended bad. You know, just like, oh my God, it was always that conversation. Why did you do that? Why do you want more? You know what I mean? So I liked stimulants, and I would stay up for long periods of time and just drink. And I would drive around Fresno at 4 o'clock in the morning, listening to the same music that I've listened to for 20 years, and that same tape playing in my mind. And I felt like I was the loneliest person on earth. Yeah. And I did that for a while, and ended up getting busted selling drugs, and went to jail. So if you notice, when I told you about the federal bank charges, it doesn't matter if it's federal or state. This was before the strike law, but I had 2 strikes. You know, and when I got that drug charge, they were going to strike me out. So I bailed out. And then what did I do? I got another one while I was out on bail. You know how bad that looks? You know how bad that looks when you have 2 strikes, you get busted with dope, you bail out, and then you get another one? Oh my gosh, that looks so bad. I mean, they looked at me, the DA and the judge, like, ooh.
Man, just head shakers. When they're doing that, man, I'm thinking, oh my gosh.
So, you know, I bailed out again. I sold everything I had and I bailed. Now I'm out on double bail. And then they're going to push the strike thing. You know, they're going to strike me out. I'm going to go to prison for the rest of my life. And probation is recommending 187 years to life. Okay? Yeah. And there's two attorneys in Fresno at the time, Eric Green and I forget the other guy's name, Dana. And, you know, they could get me out of this. They could get me a drug program. You know, they could get me Salvation Army or something, you know. And but they want like $50,000. There's only one way I know how to get $50,000. No, it's not the bank. It's not the bank, no. It's not the bank. You know, remember I did a lot of cocaine with bank money? So I run into my connection's wife that I used to actually go get it from her. And she loved me because I always had all this bank money. I'd be like, here, give me as much cocaine as you can. You know, and I ran into her at a motel. And her brother, I guess, or something, was a huge cartel methamphetamine supplier. So she's telling them, hey, he's a good guy. Miguel's a good guy. Give him anything he wants. And I'm thinking, man, I could just sell a bunch of meth, make a bunch of money, pay my attorneys, go to a drug program, and it'll be okay. So now I'm selling meth, and I'm getting money. I'm giving their retainer. I got the retainer paid for, and I still owe them like 30 grand. And I'm thinking, man, I gotta sell more meth, but it takes so long to sell a quarter here. It's just too much. And somebody wants to buy 6 pounds. If I just sell the 6 pounds, dude, I'm going to go to the drug program. Yeah, I'm going to get out of this. And what happened was, here we go. You ready for this one? I met the guy that I was supposed to sell the 6 pounds. And I met him, and something told me that he was a cop. And I'm thinking, but the connection that I was going through said he had a 67 Camaro convertible. And he goes, that's for you when you come back. You can have it. I'm a car guy, man. I was thinking about getting that car. I wasn't worried about cops or nothing. He was a cop that I was selling the 6 pounds to. So the IceNet got me on a conspiracy case for selling 6 pounds out on double bail after probation had recommended 187 years. And I also had a Tech 9 in the trunk and a 357 in the car with multiple strikes. Yeah, oh God, that's what I said too. Oh God. And what happened was, I went to jail, and you know what? When they put me in cuffs, I had the biggest sigh of relief. Because I'd been removed from society before. And the time that I spent away from the drugs and the alcohol, and I was able to pray on a daily basis and actually seek God daily and meditate while I'm running the track, and I'm healthy and I'm sleeping, you know what I mean? And I'm making amends through the mail. You know, I was working a program during those years in incarceration. And it was just like, I don't have to do this. I don't have to carry this burden anymore. I was okay. I was like, okay. Yeah, man. And I just kind of gave it to God, man. It's good. So I'm going to court. And those attorneys return the retainer. So I have like $20,000. I'm thinking, wow. They're thinking, no, we're not going to represent you now for 50. You just got another conspiracy case. So I got a conspiracy case. I got 2 possession charges, 2 gun charges. And there was a guy in the program named Mac McGinnis, who was the former district attorney for Fresno. And he was in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was able to hire him. And he fought for a drug program for me. And I didn't get it, by the way. I went back to prison. But he fought, you know what I mean? And he got all my strikes struck except for one, okay? And Judge Nunez was going to give me Delancey Street.
You know what I mean? And I was thinking, yeah, I'm gonna get this drug program after all. I'm gonna get out of this, man. And then the district attorney, she was beautiful, by the way. And she stood up and she said, Mr. Lacey, you're not going to Delancey Street or any other street. And I was thinking, that's kind of cold-blooded, man. But it's kind of funny at the same time. You know what I mean? You know, so I went to California Department of Corrections. And I did that for 11 years at 80%. So I served almost 9 years in the California Department of Corrections. During that time, I sold heroin. Power and control is what the alcoholic wants. I've been wanting power and control all my life because I felt that I did not have that. You know? So everything's great. I got the best cell. I got all these different cars, the Southerners and the whites, and all these different races. I got everything on lock. I got a lower bunk chrono, TV, packages coming all the time, fancy tennis shoes. I have everything you could possibly want inside a prison. You know, when I'm in my cell one day, and this is August 24th, 2001, and I hadn't drank or used anything in quite some time before that, probably a couple of years, but I was still manipulating, I was still lying, I was still doing everything I had to do to take care of, the psychologist says, little Michael. That's what I've been trying to do all my life. And I'm looking around my cell on the 24th, and I'm thinking, man, I got it going on. I'm looking, I got all these jars of coffee and all the, they call them Zoom Zooms and Wham Whams. So I got all this stuff, man. I got these honey buns and candy bars, and man, I got it going on. And I walk over out of my cell, and I look out the window, and I can see the field out there, and I got it going on. And if I flag my door, the cop in control, he'll open my door for me because I got it going on. And I work at PIA 16 hours a day because I got it going on. I got the best pay number in the state of California. 95 cents an hour for a state inmate is pretty much, and I would do 16 hours a day. You know, and I had it going on. And a voice came to me in that cell of 249 Low, A2, Wasco, California, 3-yard. And the voice said, and this is all you will ever have. But it wasn't the same voice. It was a different voice, and it was the voice of God that I didn't know, that I had been severed from by my own selfishness, my own dishonesty, my own resentment, my own fears. You know, I had walked away from God that probably loved me the entire time. Looking back, I can see all those connections that were made for me. The path that was laid out, you know? And I had to walk the path that I had to walk to get where I'm at today. It's a long path to Rio Grande. You know, so I made a decision when I heard that voice. And no, I didn't flush all the heroin down the toilet. I should have, but I didn't. That would have been more impactful. Like, yeah, and I flushed all the heroin. No, I got together with the other guys that did that stuff on the yard, and I told them I'm done. I'm done. I'm going to walk a different way. And I started my recovery in the prison. And that was August 24th. And my clean date, my sobriety date is August 27th because I still had heroin for 3 more days. And I got rid of it. On the 27th, I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I do not understand Him. Okay? And I did that. I started going to meetings inside. I started attending the Sweat Lodge regularly to strengthen that connection with that greater power, that power greater than myself. And I did it consistently. And I still had about another 4 years before I got out. And I knew that when I got out that I should probably continue to address this. And I didn't do that the first time. I made that mistake once already. So when I got out, I had a sponsor in mind. And I heard that he had stayed sober because we had the same sponsor coming in. In 91, 92, he got sober in 91. I tried to get sober for a little while before prison in 92. So I went and met Jeff L. at the Alamo Club, and I asked him to be my sponsor. And during that time, I've attended meetings regularly, helped others, been of service, and I've kept coming back. And I haven't drank, and I haven't used drugs. I haven't even wanted to be honest. I haven't even wanted to. It's been removed from me. You know, today I have a choice. You know, the alcoholic that doesn't drink has a choice. You know, once I start drinking, I have no choice. You know, so today in a synopsis, I'm gonna run it down for you. So, a lot of meetings, always in service. I really enjoy speaking. I get to speak all over. I've spoke at like big conventions, different places. My sponsor volunteers me. I volunteer him. It's a good time. I'm happy, joyous, and free today. I'm still selfish. I'm still dishonest. I'm still resentful, and I'm still fearful, but not as much. You know, I'm not fearless, but I fear less. Okay. And today's it's a life worth living. You know, and I've been a painter most of my life. So I started that in high school. I painted all my life, and you know, I got out. I worked for a couple different larger contractors, and then I broke off, started doing my own thing, unlicensed, of course, cash jobs, and I was killing it. You know, the alcoholic mouth, and making all this cash, buying these cars and motorcycles, and woo, not paying no taxes. Yes, and my sponsor says, "You ever think about getting your license?" I'm thinking, what? Why the hell would I get my license, dude? You have to like pay taxes and all kinds of stuff, man. And I listened to that for a couple years, and then I'm thinking, they're not going to give me a contractor's license. Dude, I got strikes and gun charges and bank robberies. There's no way. He says, well, do the footwork and leave the results up to God. So took a couple classes, passed both the tests first time, went down, submitted it, paid the $400, whatever it was. Got a letter back, and I let them know about all my charges and my felonies and the prison time. And they sent me a letter back. We're sorry and regret to inform you we cannot issue you a contractor's license because you did not put down a drunk driving from December 2nd, 1990. Remember the Butterfields beer? Apparently, I didn't put it down because I thought the bank robberies and the conspiracy and the gun charges were more important. And I left it out. So anyway, we rectified it, and I got my contractor's license. And today I pay a shitload of taxes. I don't have a drawer full of money from the bank or from work anymore at all. But the last 14, 15 months since October 22, I've been volunteering at the state prison. I go in, Native American. People ask me, are you Indian? No, just my grandma and my grandpa. And so I go in every other Sunday, and I run the sweat lodge for inmates at Valley State Prison in Chowchilla. And I went in as a volunteer, escorted volunteer. And then I met with the warden, and they gave me an unescorted brown card. So now I go in, I turn in my ID, they give me my state ID, they give me keys, and a body alarm and a rape whistle. I love the rape whistle. I tell the inmates in there, don't make me blow this whistle on you. I'll blow this whistle on you right now. And they know I get to share with them where I came from. And every time I walk into that prison with my keys on and my body alarm and my rape whistle, I look up. I thank God, because there's no way that could happen. You know, there's no way that could happen, but it did. And Tuesday, I'll be in Sacramento at the office of the California Department of Corrections. And some local tribes here in California that have endorsed me to be hired by the state to run sweat lodges in the prisons. And it's a miracle. And I want to work at CMC East. That's my desire. My intentions are good. Whether or not I'll be there, I really hope I am. That would be great. I could come to this meeting more often. But you know, that's my life today. You know, I have a simple life today. I try to minimize my damage. I try to be of service. I just try to let people know that we don't know where this journey ends. Sometimes we don't even know where it begins.
But living life one day at a time, working the steps, there is a solution, and we have hope today. Where's Jake at? Jake, I love you, man. I'll keep coming back. Thank you.
Please give Michael another round of applause.